This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 16th of March, 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch, your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we're broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. The show's going out on FM radio and through our internet live stream. However you're listening, we're also available as a podcast later from the Sheffield Live website. Talking podcasts, did you miss last week's programme? We were talking with James and with Paul from the Food Circle supermarket. They sell food that is close to use-by date at a reduced cost, healthy food, and they help people access it. It avoids landfill, it avoids food being wasted, and they talked about their startup business. Also on the programme, Elizabeth Chasser, author, entrepreneur. She's written a book about how to become a fearless leader, and she gave a succinct and clear description of some of the ups and downs in her career to date, and her career, as she put it, as being a tech startup who's non-tech savvy. Really fascinating to talk with Elizabeth. If you missed last week's programme, then panic not. The podcast is up on the Sheffield Live website. Go to sheffieldlive.org, look up radio shows, find podcasts, and you'll be able to listen to Elizabeth and to Paul and to James. But that was then, this is now. And on the programme today, I'm delighted to welcome Sarah David to the programme, and she's going to be well, it's going to be fascinating. I know it's going to be fascinating because I've just been talking with Sarah for half an hour before coming on the programme, and well, we have so much to talk through today about, you'll have to wait. You'll have to wait and see what Sarah has to tell you. But before that, what's been going on in your business and social enterprise this week? I've been down to London on Tuesday for a fascinating event called Beyond Good Business and Beyond Good Deals. This was bringing together investors, people who want a financial return, but also in many cases wanting a social return on their money. So they want their money to do good. And it was bringing them together into a room with social entrepreneurs, social enterprises. And, well, the twain did meet, but do they speak the same language? Not always, it seems, because only 1% of social enterprises have actually taken on social investment. And some of the investors are actually, believe it or not, struggling to get their money out, struggling to invest in social enterprises. They want to, but they can't always do so. And there's so much talk about investment readiness and how social enterprises should become investment ready. But someone on the stage at the event made the point that actually maybe it's the investors who need to become ready to invest themselves. There was also discussion around spreadsheets and storytelling. Someone called Susan Actemel, who runs Homes for Good in Scotland. Now, this is a business that provides housing to vulnerable people. It provides affordable housing. It's a great, robust, sustainable social enterprise. It creates a surplus, and she's been supported by a number of social investors herself and by responsible finance providers herself too. But she talks about when she's making a pitch to investors, how she loves to give them the spreadsheets. She needs to give them the spreadsheets, but she has to give them a story as well, because the spreadsheets help people to rationalize the decision they make. They make them say, yes, this makes sense. I can invest in this. But the stories make people proud of doing so. They make people really proud to do that, to back those social enterprises. There was another investor on this. Well, there was an investor on the stage by the name of Amy Clark. She has a background in wealth capital and has made all sorts of traditional investments. So if you're running a business or a social enterprise and you're ever looking for investment support, then bear these words in mind from Amy. She said the same. We seem to have lost the art of storytelling, and investors want to know the impact of the money that they make. So if you're approaching an investor, an angel, Even a bank or a community development finance institution, you need to give them the figures and those need to be robust, but you also need to make sure you're showing them what you can do and why you can do it. So fascinating to go down to that event this week. And we do have a short interview with Dulma Clark. She's set up a social enterprise called Soul of Africa. We'll be playing that later during the show. And that's only a 3-minute interview, but it's about a brilliant and truly innovative business. And I use the word innovative sparingly because it is so overused. Anyway, what else is going on in business and social enterprise? Well, what are you up to? We're always keen on hearing from you. You can tweet during the course of the program. You can email. You can text. So tweet Jamie Veach. Yes, that's me. I nearly forgot. Text 07904-272-200. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Drop us an email, jamie@sheffieldlive.org, because whether you're running a business or a social enterprise, we're always really keen to hear from you. What else has been going on this week? Well, we've continually talked about gender pay gap, and of course, HSBC's figures were revealed yesterday. Pretty horrifying, because it really looks as though they're paying men twice as much as women. And the gender pay gap reporting deadline looms. There is going to be many, many more instances of horrifying figures coming up. I think we've talked this through quite a lot on the show. I think we'll talk about it a bit today as well. And do have a listen to previous shows with Jay Biani, in which she and I have talked about this as well. But without further ado, it's time to welcome our guest today to the programme. And I'm really pleased that Sarah David's come in. Sarah, good morning.
Good morning, Jamie.
Thank you very much for coming in today. How are you?
I'm really well, thank you.
Good, super. So it's really great if we can simply introduce you in your own words. Who are you? What do you do? And how do you help people?
Thank you. So I'm Sarah David. I run a management consulting business called Thrive. And I talk about that being a business that is for people who don't have time for consultants. Time being that critical factor, right? Whatever the size of business, we don't have enough time, sometimes. So helping people see they do actually have enough time to do the things that are important, and giving them tools and tactics to do that. I interned at Franklin Covey back in my early 20s, Stephen Covey, The Seven Habits of Highly Successful People.
Yes, now that's a book that's had an impact worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. And Jamie can see I'm sitting here with my Franklin planner that I still use. It's not the same one, but I still use it 25 years later. So very much working with teams and leaders to transform the way that they work together with the aim of improving financial performance. That's generally what I'm working on.
Great. So this is a lovely description in terms of you're a management consultant for people who don't have time for management consultancies, but you're working with people in a transformative way.
That's
and
right.
The type of people that you work with, the type of organisations is pretty diverse.
Yes, it really is. So really from very large, so one of my current clients is a £4 billion PLC, all the way through to small but really powerful charities, perhaps in the Northwest.
Right.
And then everything in between. So SMEs, private equity backed organizations, social enterprises, and then private partnerships. Having been a lawyer myself in the past, that's a particular area of expertise.
Great. Okay. Now I'd like to ask you about your career history and being a lawyer and the skills that has given to you as well that you use now in a few minutes. But before we do that, that is indeed a diverse range of organisations that you work with. And some might say, well, what does a multi-million or even 4 billion turnover organisation have in common with a one-person startup or with a charity? And I actually know that from interviewing so many people on this program who come from diverse backgrounds and organisations, that many folk face very similar charities. can't get the words out today, face very similar challenges despite the difference in organisations. Is that something that you find?
Absolutely. And as you say, we'll come on to talk about my career, but I suppose the biggest switch I made was when I was a member of the executive of a £1.5 billion law firm, and then I moved to become chief exec of a £1 million autism school. Hmm. But as long as you're dealing with people, the challenges really do remain absolutely the same. You've obviously got scale differences, yes, and I'm not denying that it's not more complex when you add cultural, national challenges on top of that. But at the core, effective communication, clarity of purpose, and leaders who are willing to inspire, motivate, and lead their teams through change, that applies whatever the size of organisation.
Yes, that's true, isn't it? Effective communication, clarity of purpose, and often people really don't necessarily have that. We muddle through, and leaders willing to inspire. Yeah. Okay, great. So, in concrete terms, if you're working with an organisation, what will they ask you to do? What will they say, Sarah is struggling with this? How can you help us? And what will be the change that you effect?
Yeah. So there tend to be three main avenues into which I start to come into an organisation. That's either through maybe they're having a big away day or a team building day or a strategy day.
Yeah.
So a set piece type thing. And what I do is I work with them both to design that day, but also I tend to do some delivery in that day. So maybe do a bit of training and development around leadership skills or how you form good habits and implement them, communication skills and so on. So do some delivery, but then work with them as a team to develop whatever the issues and objectives they've got for the day. So I'm doing a bit of the inspiring and a bit of the sort of leadership,
yes,
but very much facilitating with the leaders the outcomes that they want to achieve. Second way that I come into the organisation is perhaps through a piece of coaching.
Yeah.
So I'm known or recommended to somebody, and there's somebody within the senior team that they want some work done with.
Okay.
So that's a second way to come into the organisation. My experience is it's rarely about the single person, right? Mm. So quite often the issues that they're facing, there'll be some personal development that we can always do. But perhaps there's some more broader cultural or team or organisational issues there. And so that can then lead into the third piece of work. Both of those pieces of work can lead into the third piece of work, which is the stuff I most enjoy.
Okay.
Which is where I actually get to work with teams, to get stuck in with them, to help them achieve the objectives that they're looking for.
Right. So getting working closely with a team, getting stuck in, as you say,
yes,
and helping them. And how long might that process be?
Yeah, so I would say that where we've been able to create the biggest transformations, that's probably been where I've been working with the team for between 6 and 9 months.
Yes.
And so those have led to things like sales teams going from, say, having a new business per month of, say, between 150 and 250,000 to 550,000 a month run rate with the same people and the same clients.
That's pretty dramatic, isn't it?
So I think having that clarity of purpose is so key. And sometimes it takes an external person coming in to give somebody perhaps the permission sometimes to drop 3, 4, 5 other things and be very clear on the one thing that we're going to initially start to move the needle on.
Yes, we can get quite easily distracted by things that are quite important, but not as important as the 2 out of 10 priorities.
Exactly. I love the Stephen Covey sand and rocks.
Right. Yeah.
Thing. So indeed. If anyone's ever seen that, you have three glass jars that are all the same size. One of the glass jars is empty, and in the other two glass jars, it's full of these big rocks. And in the other glass jar, it's sort of three quarters full, isn't it,
yes,
Jamie, of
right.
sand. Yeah. And what Stephen Covey would say to people is, okay, I want you to get both of these things into this third jar. And of course, the critical thing is that if you put the sand in first, there's absolutely no way that the rocks will fit in.
Quite, yep.
But if you put the big rocks in first, you can tip the sand in and it beautifully fills it all up. And there you go. And if, what I say to most people, email is generally sand, people. Mm. Email is generally sand. So, yeah, just really helping people focus within their teams. What's been the sand that's got people stuck?
Yeah.
And what are some of those big rocks that actually they can focus on?
And indeed, that's a very, very good description as well. And if you haven't come across it, you put it across so well there, Sarah, of course, anyway. But email, we get stuck in our inboxes for hours and distracted, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. And it is just saying to people, what is the sand?
Mm.
What is the sand that is pulling your team down?
Yeah.
What's getting you stuck and bogged down? And what are those critical rocks? And as I say, particularly when you're a leader of a team, you've also got to give people in your team the permission. You've got to give them the permission that actually it's okay not to do some of that sand, provided that the focus there is on the big rocks and they're making those main things happen. And I am, the planning thing is such a key one, of course, because that going from knowing to doing,
yes,
right? So
indeed,
we all know, every single person listening to the show knows that if you eat well and do some exercise, yep, you'll lose weight and you'll stay fit,
mm-hmm,
right? There is nobody who doesn't know that. And yet, so it's the same thing on this. We may know that we're getting run into the sand, but what tactics are we using in order to put us in a position where we're not falling into that? And so that thing of knowing the night before what the big rock is that you're going to tackle the next day, that's probably my biggest tip to people, as a shortcut. That's the easiest way to not fall into the sand, because you know what the rock is and you can go at it.
Quite, yes. And famously, this is perhaps one of the most famous time management tips of all time, and it's 100 years old. The I can't remember the person's surname, but was commissioned by an industrialist called Schwab in America to do some management consulting 100 years ago. And the consultant said, well, I'll give you a tip and you don't have to pay me for it. You can just pay me what it's worth to your business. All you do, and this was a business that was already very, very successful.
Yes, yes, yes.
And the tip was, all you need to do is the day before, at the end of each working day, you write down the six key things that you are going to do tomorrow, and then you work through them with no distraction, one by one, and you know what you're going to do at the start of the day. And it's very easy, and it's probably even easier now than it was 100 years ago, to get distracted as a leader, to open up your laptop or turn on your phone even, and your time being taken by responding to things rather than doing the priorities. But that tip from 100 years ago still stands. And three months after being given the tip, Schwab paid the management consultant a fee, or wrote out a check for something in the region of $40,000, somewhere equivalent to a much higher amount in today's money, saying this has transformed an already successful business. So that will resonate, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think your point about distractions is, there is absolutely no doubt that it is so much harder not to get distracted today. And I would say certainly in the teamwork I do, but also in the coaching work I do with senior people, we inevitably end up having discussions at some point about smartphones, about sleep, and about distractions generally. I talk to people, when I talk about habits, I talk about gateway drugs.
Mm-hmm.
and being really mindful about what your gateway drugs are.
Oh, no,
right?
Yes.
So this idea that actually, you know, if you're aware that if you open up a particular website, that you might well end up frittering away 20, 40 minutes on that website, then just be conscious of the gateway drugs that are there. Often I talk about box sets. You know, box sets and Netflix can be a gateway drug to wine, alcohol and chocolate and crisps. So just being mindful about what are some things that lead you to other places. So don't do those other things. Or if you do them, be aware the choice that you're making.
Yes, be aware indeed. Yeah. And I think that takes us on to something that I wanted to ask you about, which you've written about, which is about being intentional as well. Because you talked about earlier on in the program, you talked about clarity of purpose. And you've talked about leadership as well, but intentional leadership. Yeah. Now, what would you mean if you were to say being intentional?
So I think this relates to the idea that in order to get to an outcome, you have to be clear about where you wanted to go to.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things about leadership, personal leadership, if we think about ourselves in our own capacity, if we set ourselves some goals and objectives, if we have an intention, obviously there's part of us that's always then concerned that what if we fail? What if we don't meet it? And that can be the reason why people don't set intentions for themselves or don't create a clarity of purpose is fear of failure if they set that for themselves and don't then make it. But the encouragement that I give people is that it's a life of less regret to have that purpose and go for it. And say, I mean, and I'm slightly digressing, but one of the things I also think about this is that sometimes an intention or a purpose we have, when we actually start down that road, turns out to be something we don't really want at all. So I was speaking to somebody recently who was he runs his own very successful business in the city of London, and he was talking to me about the fact that he really wanted to be Andrew Marr.
Right. Okay. Right?
What he really wanted to be was actually Andrew Marr. He really didn't want to be making pots of money, you know, doing this city type job. And so we had a session where we talked about, okay, let's break it down. Right. If you want to be Andrew Marr, let's break it down to what you might be able to start doing today on the road to becoming Andrew Marr. And what we identified was probably some political blogging and writing.
Okay.
That could be a good way into this. Establish a reputation in that way. That might then lead to him interviewing politicians. Da, da.
Yeah.
Well, Jamie, let me tell you, he did this for 3 weeks. And at the end of this 3 weeks, he announced to me he definitely didn't want to be Andrew Marr. that this writing and blogging malarkey was really not what he, and you know, the discipline of doing that and da, da, da. And so I think that was the point. He could have got to a point down the line of feeling regretful about never having become Andrew Marr, when in actual fact, by testing and trying it, it wasn't actually what he wanted it to be. So
he knew,
he tested it and tried, and he'd had the courage to do that. So a side project, so my consulting business is Thrive, but a side project I've been developing with a colleague, Richard Ferguson, is called Love Work More.
Yes, indeed.
And part of our passion, the two of us in that, is we want to give people the ability to take that first step, to have the courage to go for that purpose and that passion and that real intention.
Right. Okay. And you've written about that first step and then three further steps too.
Yes.
And we'll come on to those during the course of the interview. But Sarah, this is absolutely fascinating, and something that is maybe unusual, maybe it isn't, is blending together commercial. You've talked about helping sales teams to move from 100,000 in revenue to 500,000 in revenue per month. with your background as a lawyer, with executive coaching, and with getting stuck in and, if you like, getting your hands dirty working with teams. This isn't the model of consulting that is, we will tell you the time and charge you for your watch or whatever the old hackneyed phrase is.
Sure.
This is about working and presumably being quite accountable with your clients as well.
Yeah.
So what of your legal history is most transferable to what you do now?
Yeah. Probably, ironically, one of the things I have to watch myself is that very strong legal training that you get to find the problem, not the solution. So I always find it interesting. I grew up in the States, and I find it interesting how in the United States, lawyers tend to go onto boards.
Yeah.
That's a very well-traveled path. And in the UK, it's very much accountants that tend to walk that path.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it?
And so I always find that quite interesting because the training is not dissimilar in terms of the legal training in the two countries. But the reputation that lawyers have, very much my experience in the UK, is spotting the problems and risk and so on, which is critical and important. Yeah. But there can be that complaint, well, yeah, but we want to make this happen. I understand these are the issues. How can we get over those issues to make it happen? So that's something that I've watched for. But I think on the flip side, a drive to get things right, to find a way through something. I was very fortunate in my legal training. I worked in one of the best law firms, probably in the world. They would say they are the best law firm in the world. And so I had this real training in excellence and rigor and detail and priding yourself on doing a first-class job. And I think those things have really stuck with me. But I think probably doing my MBA when I went on to do that, being fortunate enough and crazy enough to do my MBA while I was working at the same time.
Right. That must have been challenging.
Yes. Yeah. It was really hard work. It was before I had the boys. So I really hat tip to anyone who's doing all three of those things.
Yeah.
But I would say that I did my MBA at Henley, and I would say that it was really valuable to the consulting work. So it is that legal thinking and skills and the structure that comes with that.
Yeah.
It's then having worked in executive roles in a real range of organizations, and then the MBA support in terms of some of that theory.
Right. Yeah.
I would say.
So the legal, the forensic element
that's a good word, yeah.
Yeah, and pulling apart and finding problems. And I appreciate what you're saying in terms of needing, in the work that you do, to present solutions and come up with solutions, not only look at problems, but that ability to take something apart must be very, very helpful.
Yeah, absolutely.
And clearly, if you're working with an organisation for your legal training that prided itself.
Absolutely.
On excellence. And now you talked about the MBA at Henley.
Yeah.
And MBAs are a considerable investment.
Yeah.
Now, in some cases, they can be funded by an employer, but quite often they're self-funded as well. And there is discussion these days about whether an MBA is something that people who are at an earlier stage in their career should consider, and whether it's worth investing their resources or their employer's resources or their own resources and their time and effort and energy, because if you're going to be doing this, as you say, it will take a huge commitment, and whether that's still something that's valuable. And, you know, even newspapers such as The Economist have looked at the pros and cons of MBAs, and The Economist makes quite a lot of money by carrying adverts for MBAs too. Yeah. Now, would you, in terms of someone who's perhaps thinking, should I do an MBA? Yeah, I want to go into the executive world. Would you say it's still something worth doing?
So I think it comes back to your intention.
Right.
So I think mapping out where you would like to be 5-10 years time and assessing it on that basis. So that's the first thing. I think you're absolutely right, the cost benefit. So I was fortunate enough, I was sponsored by Linklaters, the firm I was working for at the time. So they sponsored me to do it. Mm. So, but that was also one of the reasons I took the role, because it was a sponsored MBA. I think it's a bit like, is there such a thing as a good school? I think there's the right school for the right child. Mm-hmm. And I think the same holds true. I don't think there's an objective answer around an MBA. I think it does come back to what's your intention and aims and objectives. But also I do think it's critically important about what's the role you're in. Mm-hmm. So I was very fortunate to be in a very, I was working for the global managing partner of Linklaters, and I was his bag carrier basically, and so I had an incredibly broad remit in my role. I was involved in every single aspect of the business, and so my MBA was incredibly valuable because MBAs by nature cover every single aspect of a business, and I was able to apply that in my day job all the time. If you're in a particular functional area, I think you have to look very hard at the course and your role to check that actually the value that you're going to get from it is going to be worthwhile.
Yes.
You know, are you actually going to be able to apply that at this stage? Or is there another way to go in terms of exec ed or the use of that money?
Yes, quite. Indeed. So if you are in a silo or in a segment, then it may be that you need to look to getting a wider remit, perhaps, or...
Yes, it could be. Or you might want to look at a more... Again, depending what your intention is over the next 5 to 10 years, to maybe look very carefully at the MBA syllabus itself.
Yeah.
And it might be that a more specialist master's, for example... Or maybe it is something like I trained as a coach. Maybe it's a coaching qualification, or there's some other you're looking to augment, aren't you, at this point in your career?
Yes, you
and,
are.
And so I think being really open to the idea, how much money am I personally willing or wanting to spend? And then if I took that pot of money, what are the different ways I could apply it?
Yes, sure. Yeah.
And then making that decision. But it certainly was a very valuable, I found it incredibly valuable thing to do.
Great. So hugely valuable if it resonates, or if it fits with your intention and where you are, where you want to be. And as you say, it's where else could you invest? And not only money, but also time.
Time, exactly.
That's a massive commitment.
Exactly.
That's a resource which is only diminishing as well. So can I ask you, Sarah, what else has brought you to the coaching and consultancy work that you're sure. doing now?
Sure. How do you want me to do this, Jamie?
You can talk about how the coaching and the consultancy has become more intentional, but if you want to talk about why it was something that you have been doing with perhaps less intent, but for the last 4 years.
Okay, that's great. Yeah, thank you. That's great. So, yes, when I suppose from when I was 30 to when I was 40, I was in these... senior executive roles in professional services firms. I was constantly on a plane.
Yep.
Very international businesses. And that's when I really was honing my change experience, getting stuck in and working inside organizations to transform and change them. And that's also when I developed actually my interest in the not-for-profit space.
Yeah.
So when I first started joining boards, leading CSR initiatives, and I did my coaching training.
Yeah.
And I was mentoring and coaching people in not-for-profits. And that's also when we adopted our boys. So it was a big, that 10 years had all of these different elements, and my Jonathan became a stay-at-home dad.
Yes.
And we played a lot less golf. And then when I was 40, we moved to Colorado. In the United States, and I ran this autism school. So went from massive to tiny, you know, went from hanging out with Chris Patton at a round table,
yes,
to sitting in a very tiny office in Denver, Colorado, with a wild group of children on the autism spectrum marauding outside the door, because we took in and supported children who were very significantly impacted by their autism in their teenage years.
Yeah.
And if we hadn't worked with these, they were mainly boys, if we hadn't worked with these boys, they would have been institutionalized. And it was incredible to watch the work that the teachers and behavior analysts and therapists did with these boys to transform not only the boys' lives, but their families and friends' lives, enabling them to communicate. The boys, when they came in, were generally had no communication skills, certainly not verbal communication skills. And the team would work with them so that they could sign or use iPads or use cues to communicate, which, you know, part of their frustration came from their inability to communicate. And a lot of them wouldn't be toilet trained when they came in.
No.
So imagine the impact on your family environment. You know, nobody wants to be in a situation where they're changing the diaper, the nappy of their 12, 13, 14-year-old son. And so, again, the team would work through all of those things. I'd come from an environment around, really around making money, right? That's in the city, professional services, to this environment where I was watching these incredible young women. They were mainly women, again, doing the teaching and development. Absolutely turning around lives. And then then we work with the itty bitty ones,
right?
So those who've been fortunate enough to get an autism diagnosis very early on.
Okay.
And so the earlier you can get that diagnosis, sometimes the more intervention you can make.
Yes.
And then we work with children in the homes and with the families. So children who are on the autism spectrum but higher functioning in typical schools, but giving them social skills and other support. And actually, you know, it wasn't that different from working in a mega law firm. It was still people, but I was dealing with parents. I was dealing with funders because it was a not-for-profit. I was dealing with teachers and therapists. And so it was that complexity that actually you have when you work in a large organization. One of the skill sets you develop is ability to deal with complex stakeholder relationships.
Yes.
And so although we only employed, I think we were about 50 to 60 people, there were incredibly complex stakeholder relationships to be managed.
Absolutely fascinating. Yeah,
thank you, Jamie.
Yeah.
So completely different, but much the same.
Yes.
And then very tragically, my husband died in a car crash while we were out there.
In Colorado.
In Colorado.
Yeah.
So that obviously threw, you know, my entire world upside down. I'd met Jonathan when I was 11. When I'd grown up in New Jersey.
Right.
And for the record, he was an incredible husband and father, and
yes,
much fun. He really was. So that was an incredibly difficult situation for me and the boys.
Oh, it must have been and be. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so since then, I've been, I'm not going to swear on the radio, but I've been kicking the four-letter word,
yes,
out of option B since,
right,
then. So Sheryl Sandberg, who's the COO of Facebook, she lost her husband very suddenly as well. He had
indeed
a heart attack, and she's also got two young children. She's written a brilliant book with Adam Grant, who's the author of another wonderful book called Give and Take. And the two of them together wrote this book called Option B.
Right.
And they talked about the fact that if you can't have option A, if option A goes, then all you can do is choose to do a hell of a job with option B.
Yes.
And to just go at that as hard as you can.
And so this is where you are.
Yes, that's right. So that's what's led to, so moved the kiddos back. We moved back here to the UK and moved up to the northwest. And then I started consulting, really, because I didn't know what to do.
Yes.
And I wanted to get back into the workplace.
Yeah.
Quickly.
So this was a case of you needed to get back into the workplace. You didn't know what to do. And I don't want to sort of sound glib, but had to fall into consulting for a while to do something after such trauma. And you've obviously been doing that incredibly well.
Thanks, Jamie.
From having met you last year when we were both giving lectures at the university and seen how your consultancy business and your side project have ramped up this year, it looks like this has now switched into another gear.
That's right. I think, when I in that 30 to 40 age, I wanted to be a lawyer since I was 9 or something.
Right.
Neither of my parents had gone to university, and so they thought this was wonderful that their daughter announced she wanted to be a lawyer. I was pretty clueless about what being a lawyer really was, really. But anyway, I went to Sheffield
yes.
University, did my law degree, went off to law school, became a lawyer. And a few years in, thought, I am not doing this for the rest of my life.
Funny, I've heard that from a few ex-lawyers.
Yeah, it was just lack of control, really, and just so much time. But I would say then it took me probably till I was about 40 to think, well, what's my next intention and
yes.
purpose? And that was to run a not-for-profit.
Yes.
So Tick sort of did that. And then, as you say, this last few years, certainly, I guess the first 4 years or so after Jonathan died, I was very much doing consulting because of the flexibility
yes.
it offered
yep.
And the variety. And although I am personally, for better or worse, I'm very personally committed to my clients, it's for a finite amount of time. Whereas when I was in that previous 10 years, that personal energy and commitment I gave to those organizations, I just wasn't in a place to do that again.
No, no.
But,
sure.
As I was saying to you before we came in, it's really in the last 18 months or so that it now feels again like a purpose and an intention to develop my consulting offering with Thrive and the side project Love Work More what we're aiming for with Love Work More is we'd love 1,000 people to have happier working lives
yes.
as a result of coming through our programs. And with Thrive, the personal satisfaction I get of working with those teams and turning things around. I love a good crisis. We can fix the crisis.
Yes.
Turning those things around. So it does feel great to have a purpose and an intention again.
Superb. That's great, Sarah. Thank you very much for being so open and candid there about your history and what you've been through. And Sheffield, so university in Sheffield.
Yeah.
Here we are in the city again. You've travelled across the Pennines today to be on the radio with us. So thanks for making the commitment to do that. The city itself has changed. I mean, I noticed how much it changed. I was at university here too, and I went to London for 7 or 8 years and then came back, and Sheffield had transformed and continues to. Did you enjoy your time at university here?
I loved it here. Yeah. And my little brother, Andrew McAdam, he also came to university here. So yeah, there's a great family fondness for Sheffield, for sure.
Super. Well, this is a fascinating discussion that we're having. Sarah David is my guest today. You're listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise program with me, Jamie Veitch. Sarah, you've been unpacking a huge amount of what you do and who you work with and the type of roles that you have. I'm fascinated about the bringing the corporate, the ability to find problems, the ability to solve problems, the ability to work with people and to help people to get the best out of themselves and their teams and their businesses. The similarities between social enterprises, between not-for-profits, which not-for-profits seem to be used perhaps more in the States than in the UK.
Yeah.
I mean, in the UK, social enterprise for profit, but depends what you do with that profit, perhaps. But the similarities between these organisations, the work in terms of supporting organisations, particularly involved with autism and autism support there, and the work with corporates and teams and startups too. Loads here. Now, I want to return to our discussion in just a couple of minutes. And I'd also like you to give us some of your recommendations for reading material, because I know you've brought some with you into the studio, and there are an enormous amount of books aimed at leaders. Some are dreadful, some are very, very good. So it's always a pleasure to hear a good recommendation for a book on this show. But before we return to that, we are going to take a very quick break for an interview which I recorded on Tuesday at the Beyond Good Deals and Good Business conference in London. And this is Dilma Clark. She's running a social enterprise called Soul of Africa. The interview is only 3 minutes. It's quite a noisy background to the interview, but we'll hear from Dilma now.
Hi, my name is Dilma Clark, and I run Soul of Africa. It's a social enterprise providing skills and jobs currently in Ethiopia. A company owned by a charity, so we're like 100% charitable enterprise. We reinvest all the profits back into communities to improve all the supply chains, provide more jobs, more training, and we also support lots of local community projects like education.
And how have you got the social enterprise started? What's the story behind getting set up?
It was started by my father-in-law, who sadly passed away last week. He started it over 11 years ago in South Africa. He used to be a former director at Clark Shoes, and since he retired, he knew how to make shoes, and then he really wanted to make a difference. He always used to say, to be a real human, you have to help others. That's when you become a human being.
Right.
So, and then he was invited to South Africa, and then he saw lots of people queuing outside for just day jobs and for like some penny jobs. I mean, lots of unemployed people, especially women carrying their children, so it was like pretty bad picture. He invited people and taught them how to make very simple moccasins, and that's where the idea started. And he got backed up by Clark Shoes, and it was a CSR program for many years. And then and I joined in 2014, registered the whole thing in the UK, and
yes,
started looking into updating the model with sustainability and creating new sort of more modern contemporary products, better different type of storytelling and tying up charity fundraising with the product design.
Yes, so you've accelerated the business considerably. You've registered here in the UK, accelerated considerably. Storytelling and showing people the impact, that's been a theme of today's conference in a big way. So how are you showing the impact of what you do?
So I just pitched at the session, and I was sort of happy to show pictures how like people were helping to employment.
Yes.
And telling the story that we enabled 18,000 children into education because we renovated schools and open nurseries. It happened because lots of women who were employed, they didn't have any place to leave their children, so it was like a story where the nursery is coming. And and then all these new designs are coming in. We collaborated with a brand called Akasa, who works with a tribe in Ethiopia called the Karo people, and they do this fascinating body painting art. And so they worked closely with them to incorporate their body painting art into products. So we can also tell this amazing African cultural stories to the world, and people would know about it, and then it's also raise awareness, change the perception how Africa is normally portrayed, and we want to inspire people.
Inspiring indeed. So where can people find out more? What website?
They can go to our website, soulofafrica.com, and products are also available at Vivo Barefoot stores in the UK, Germany, Czech Republic, America. They're available on Amazon, Yeah, so basically they just Google South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa.
Come
yeah. Wonderful. Well, Duma, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Joining me. And
thank
all
you.
The best. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. Are you running a business or social enterprise? Are you doing something really interesting, really different? And would you like to be on the programme? Well, get in touch. Send an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org, a text to 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Whether you're running or starting a business or a social enterprise, whether you're an employer, an employee, self-employed, solopreneur, we'd love to hear from you, so please get in touch. And we've just heard from Dorma Clark at Soul of Africa, and I'm really sorry that the audio quality was poor. That was the best quality we possibly could get at the conference where I interviewed Dorma earlier on this week. But check out her website, Soul of Africa. It's operating on a buy one, give one model in terms of you buy a lovely pair of shoes and someone else gets a pair of shoes, which will help them get to school or work in Ethiopia. So do check out Soul of Africa, a great business, a thriving business. And on the point of thriving, Sarah David, my studio guest today, runs Thrive Consulting. Sarah, welcome back.
Thanks, Jamie.
I've really enjoyed this chat today. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Me too.
Really great to have you here in the studio. Thank you for coming in. Now, business books.
Mm.
You have recommended books. I've heard you stand up and recommend books. And the lovely old question, what book have you gifted most
yes,
to people? So
yes.
Do you want to tell me some books that you...
Sure. People who know me know I could speak on... hours on this topic, and I had a very quick check actually from a recent coachee who said to me, why do you think the answer to this lies in a book? And I thought it was a very good sort of check and balance on me.
Yeah,
you're right, why does the answer lie in a book? And in that case it was one of the books that I have been recommending very highly over the last 12, 18 months, which is Emotional Agility.
Mm-hmm.
It's by a woman called Susan David, no
yep.
relation. And there's a decent TED talk on it as well. And she talks about the fact that between a stimulus, between something that prompts you and your response, there is a space. And what
right.
we choose to do in that space defines who we are. So that's a recently highly gifted book. Probably the book I've most gifted and recommended over the last 15 years is a book called Working Identities.
Okay.
By the author, it's not very radio friendly, is it? Herminia Ibarra is
right.
her name. And that is fantastic case studies for people who feel at a turning point in their career. You feel stuck. The case studies are all aimed, I think they're all at people aged 30 to 55. And she has some brilliant theories and tactics in there to support you on the journey. If you're thinking about what shall I don't know what to do with my life. I don't know what to do with my working life. And it's a
right.
really good book.
Working Identities.
Working Identities.
Great. Super. Great recommendation.
Playing Big mm-hmm. by a woman called Tara Moore. I think the subtitle is For the Brilliant Woman You Are.
Yeah.
And although it is aimed at women, this is a book that actually I have recommended to men who perhaps in the workplace have stronger feminine stereotypical skills mm-hmm. and approaches than male ones. It's an outstanding book, very easy to read. And it's this idea to step up and play big, ask for what you
yes.
want. You're more likely to get it. If it's just in your head, it's a bit difficult for anyone to give it to you.
Okay, now that sounds fascinating and well worth reading by any reader. Yeah,
yes, indeed. Yeah, absolutely. So Playing Big, Tara Moore. Do you want any more, Jamie?
Oh, yes, please.
Okay. Tribe of Mentors by
yep.
Tim Ferriss. I recommend this to people who don't read.
Mm-hmm.
So quite often I need books for people that's going to give them some insights, but they're not a reader.
Yeah.
And this is great because it takes all of his radio interviews and his podcasts, puts them down on paper, but you can dip in and dip out. You can literally pick it up.
Bite-sized,
yep. read it. And it's, I mean, he interviews such a range of people,
he does,
right?
Doesn't he? Yes.
So I think it's useful because it comes from the world of sport, music, business, media, tech, investment. So it's a very chunky book. You can use it as a doorstop. But as I say, it's great for people who are thinking, well, I'm in business and I should be learning, but I'm just not a reader.
Yeah.
This is a really good one.
Highly accessible.
Yeah, really accessible.
Excellent.
One more, but
you've only got 20 seconds on it.
Reasons to Stay Alive by Matt Haig.
Oh, yes, that's a wonderful book. Yep, absolutely wonderful book, packed with humanity and humour.
And humour. Highly successful author who suffers from depression.
Yep.
Mental health issues don't have to prevent you.
Indeed. A sterling recommendation there. Super. Well, Sarah, thank you so much for coming in today. I'd like you to give some details of what you do, how people can get in touch with you, the Love Work More programme, your website.
Great.
So
thank you. Thank you. So, yes, you can. My website is thrive.co.com, because somebody else has already got the .com. So thrive.co.com. You can find me on Twitter on Saz Davey. And then Love Work More. We are Love Work More on Twitter, Love Work More on Facebook, Love Work More on LinkedIn. And we're running our 2-hour sessions in Manchester on the 12th of April and 18th of May. And our 90-day program kicks off in Manchester on Wednesday, the 18th of April.
Great. And details again
on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn.
Okay. I will tweet the links out to those. So even if you don't have a Twitter account yourself, if you just follow, look up Jamie Veitch on Twitter, I will link through to Sarah's links,
Jamie,
as well. So they're easy to find. That's it for today. Packed program. Sarah David, thank you so much for joining us today. Fascinating to speak with you. Really, really enjoyed our discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie.
You've been listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme with me, Jamie Veitch. We're back on air next Friday from 9 through to 10. Michael Sheen is on the programme, the Hollywood actor and activist. Yes, he is. So tune in then. Don't go away now, because next up on Sheffield Live, our fantastic folk music programme, Thank Goodness It's Folk, from 10 through to noon. So enjoy that. We're going to play out with a track of music chosen by Sarah David, our guest today. This is The Cure, In Between Days. Thank you for listening.
This is Sheffield Live.
We're open for business live.